God, please help me set aside everything I think I know about myself, my disease, these steps, and especially you. For an open mind and a new experience with myself, my disease, these steps, and especially you. Tonight we are on Into Action. No, how it works.
How it works.
How it works.
Chapter 5, how it works.
Without further ado, Tim.
Thank you, David. Good evening, everyone. I'm a recovered alcoholic. My name's Tim.
Hi, Tim.
Thank you again for everyone who been coming on a weekly basis, and those of you who have been sparsely coming, and those of you who are here tonight. Wonderful. My usual disclaimer, this is my experience, strength, and hope with the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I in no way represent the opinion of Alcoholics Anonymous, although there will be times that I sound like I do, and I always apologize in advance for that. And, you know, it's still part of my defects of character, but there it is. What was I going to say? Nothing important happened this week, which is always nice. You know, when you know, you have a week that's fairly even keel, no drama, chaos. So that's nice to report. Obviously, I'm still battling this this evil cold, but don't worry, God will take us through it. So tonight we're starting on page 58, chapter 5, How It Works. The opinion section right now is about to start. I always find it amazing when I go to meetings, you know, and I hear it. And I've heard it for years. Years I've heard it. You know, I don't know how it works. Like, well, there's an entire chapter that says how it works. Like, so I'm always like, I always look askance at those people like, well, did you read it? You know, did you practice it? Now, I'm not talking about people who are fairly new to recovery. That I can understand, that jumbledness of like, you know, that first 5 years of what am I doing, like without a drink, and how does this work? You know, I get that, but I'm talking about people who are sober, you know, 10 plus years, 20 years, who say, I don't know how it works, and that just really scares me. It really scares me. So to that end, you know, I look forward to chapter 5 and chapter 6, because to me this is, you know, as we've read about earlier, the clear cut directions on how we've recovered, and here they are, and chapter 5 and 6 really go through, they reiterate steps 1 and 2, and then go through the rest of the process up to step 11 in just those two chapters. So there's a lot of stuff there, and I always get very excited about that, as you'll probably see as we go on. Obviously, I'll probably say some controversial things, and that's how it works. So the first sentence of page 58 of How It Works: rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. And here we go. You know, it becomes that other thing that I've heard so many times. You know, people standing from podiums and almost thumping the podium by saying, you know, Bill Wilson was asked if there was any word he would ever change in the big book, it would be rarely to never. And I hold in my hand a section from the Alcoholics Anonymous website, from their frequently asked questions section, which is a new feature of theirs. There is a Grapevine article. For those of you who don't know, the Grapevine is what they call our meeting in print. It has wonderful historic value. Our preamble comes from the Grapevine. It started in June 1944. And there is an article about all the different references as to when Bill was asked that throughout the time. And there's two references here. The last one that says, it says, question, has Bill ever said, if there was any change he would make in the big book, it would be to change the word rarely to never at the start of chapter 5. And the answer is no. Bill said he never considered this. And that's from the 1970 General Service Conference report on page 31. I invite you to look that up. The website is AA.org. There is that section. Also in front of me is the book Pass It On, which is the official biography of Bill Wilson. Okay, and on page 200 in that book, it specifically talks about that he never considered changing rarely to never. And he did that specifically, and it goes on to talk about, there's another reason for that. He felt, and these are his words, that he didn't want to give the notion that there was 100% possibility of recovery by using that word, because it would open us up to controversy. And but yet he goes on to say, but if you do follow it thoroughly, you're going to have 100% recovery. I happen to agree with that. So So that's the beginning, and here we are, first sentence, and we're off to the races. So, okay, those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. Now, I've met lots of people who thought they were of this type, and they weren't. In reference to being constitutionally incapable, I've come to learn that it's generally people who are sociopaths, people who do not know the difference between right and wrong. I've yet to meet somebody in AA. I've met lots of people who were close, but, I've never met anybody who did not know the difference between right and wrong. So they have the ability to recover. And he goes on to say that. Constitutionally incapable of being honest with them. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. We've discussed this a couple times. I've mentioned this. I'm one of those people who have a grave emotional and mental disorder. Those are outside issues that I deal with outside. However, as the result of, because I like that that's in there, because there's that, let me find the loophole. Oh, well, I suffer from this, and I suffer from that, so therefore, this isn't going to work for me. And he kind of cuts through the crap right there, and says, yeah, that's great. Can you be honest? Yeah, I can be honest. Okay, you can recover. And then, okay. So that's really cool. Now, I don't know if anybody else realized it. Honesty is mentioned 3 times in that one paragraph, the first paragraph of how it works. So, I guess it's kind of important, right? That it's about honesty. And we mentioned this when we were going through we agnostics and the spiritual experience, that honesty, open-minded, and willingness are essentials for this to work. Now, he goes on to say, our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. And we've seen those stories. We've heard them. There's the stories that Dr. Silkworth puts forth in the doctor's opinion. There's Bill's story, himself. Ebby's story within Bill's story. There's the story of Roland Hazard. There's the story of Jim. There's the story of Fred. There's Hank's story at the end of the last chapter we read. So we've seen them. He's told us in a general way what happened, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now for those people. Now, I love this. This is one of my, trump card, if you will, one of those things that come up. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. Now, if you were anything like me, when you got here, you wondered, what is it that they have? They're not drinking. Yeah, I want that. Okay. And it was like, wait a minute. No, that's not what we have. And we've seen it twice, at least, specifically on page 25, and then reiterated again on 50 and 51, about what it is that we have as recovered people, that we have a deep, effective, spiritual connection with our higher power, that it's the central fact in our lives today, that that's how we run our life, that we rely on God, and that's where it's at. So when presenting, a newcomer. Oh, we have to be gentle with them. No, we don't. I mean, I just went through this a couple nights ago, with a newcomer. And it's like, books were being discussed. And I said, well, have you heard of this one book? It's blue, and it has gold writing on it. He said, would you be referring to the big book? I said, yeah, you've heard of it? He said, yeah, I'm not a fan. I said, well, go somewhere else. And I walked away, because to me, that's somebody who doesn't want what I have. And I'm not going to stand there and convince them that they should want what I have. I don't care. I know what I have. And I'll give hours and hours and hours toward anybody who wants what it is that I have. And I will go to any length to give that to them, as long as they're willing to go to any length to get it. And I always think about, it's funny, a little knowledge sometimes is dangerous, obviously. And you get that, my grand sponsor said this, and I'm going to tell you that now. And I'm like, oh, that's nice. And it continues and continues. And for those of you who remember the person who was trying to tell me, you know, how the first time about how I was supposed to speak in a meeting, and then tried to, like, well, this is how the founders and this, and meanwhile they had like less than 30 days. And so I found myself saying, you know, if I want what you have, I'll drink again. You know, and because that's what I was presented with. I mean, that's I could only pass on what was taught to me. And that was the attitude that I had. Like, I came in, I was young when I came in. I thought I knew everything. Anybody else do that? No. And it was like, oh, you think you know, kid, huh? And I still get that. Years later, I still get that. And, you know, it becomes a thing of like, well, if you've decided, do you want what we have? Okay, so now let me get to, like, okay, I've decided that. I want what you have. Okay, now are you willing to go to any length to get it? Because that really becomes the caveat, you know. It becomes like, well, it depends, you know. What are you going to make me do? You know, and if you're anything like me, I like to screw with people when they say that. You know, I'll give them, like, well, there's the sacrifice every third Tuesday. You know, there's those little things. And you watch them go, but I can't do that. You know, and it's like, relax. You just have to, like, trust what we're asking you to do. So, you know, it's an always interesting thing. And then you're ready to take certain steps. It doesn't say, then you're ready to go to meetings, or you're ready to get, you know, a greeting commitment or a coffee commitment, or you're ready to go out and speak. It doesn't say that. It says, then you're ready to take certain steps. If you want what we have, you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. So that's step zero. That's not even being prepared for the process yet. So, and it talks about that earlier on in the book, like, armed with the facts about ourselves, we can generally win over the confidence of another alcoholic in a couple hours. And until such a middle road can be met, little or nothing can be accomplished. So, it becomes that, almost a qualifier, really. Like, oh, you're new, great, hey, all right. Well, you know what it is that we do here? You know, and I'm always real staunch about that. This is a life and death thing that we do here. This isn't like, oh, you know, things are a little difficult right now. Having a hard time at work. Having a hard time. No, you're going to die. You're going to die. Oh, I don't know about that. Okay, we'll go test it. You know, and because I've seen it. I've seen, like, the most well-dressed people who people said, oh, they got it going on. It's great. I'm like, they're going to die. I'm like, what are you talking about? I'm like, they're full of crap. They're running around talking like, oh, I got this, and they don't have a thing. And, you know, sometimes I hate being right sometimes, because within, like, 2 weeks, you'll hear about that person who died. Oh, did you hear about so-and-so? What happened? Oh, they bled out in their apartment. What? They were just at a meeting the night before. Okay, and, you know, they didn't have what we have. You know, so I obviously, I go to great pains to explain that, you know. Okay. And it says that some of these we blocked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. I had the privilege of seeing a man celebrate 50 years of recovery. Bill D. He used to start a lot of meetings in this area. He was around before the General Service Conference was around. Uh-huh. And I was at his 50th. And he said, I'm a lazy drunk. And I'm always looking for the easier, softer way. He says, and I found the easier, softer way. And it's don't drink and go to meetings. Mm-hmm. I threw my hands up. I was so excited. And he said, I've seen people come in and do that for 25, 26 years and, you know, and die sober. He says, but they didn't get the benefits and the joy of living that I have. Mm-hmm. And I thought, like, wow, there's somebody with 50 years talking about the joy of living and the benefits of life. Now, this is a man who survived his wife dying in a car crash and didn't drink. You know, and at the end of his life, he was he had incontinence and wore adult diapers. And here's a man celebrating and talking about, hey, the easier, softer way's out there. We found it. Because, of course, we would, you know. And so go follow that one, and maybe you'll get half of what I have. And I just remember thinking, like, oh, yet another log I can throw on my fire, you know. And so I just love that. And then he, Bill says, with all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. And I think I try to do that. With all the earnestness at my command, I beg of people to be thorough and honest from the very start. Because if you're just going to BS yourself and me, it's just never going to work. You may find other people that could co-sign it, but how long is that going to last? You know. So I beg people, please, please, if you want to live, please do this. Right? Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. That's pretty confrontational right there. You know, old ideas. Yeah, okay. You know, I say this all the time. They told me that I was wrong about everything. How could I be wrong about everything? Well, you're in AA, aren't you? And so once I was able to, anytime I'm stuck in an old idea and I'm spinning my wheels in the mud, my result is nil. And I go, oh, okay. Wait, do you think you have a better idea? And then somebody comes along, yeah, sure. And they hear, let's put this plank under your wheel and I'll give you a little push. And then it works. And hey, look at that. I let go. Absolutely. And somebody else took care of it, and or maybe sent somebody to help me with this. And oh, I get it. Another God moment. Another like epiphany. Oh, I'm wrong. God will help me when I ask. And there it is. You know, so it's really cool. And then he gives that wonderful warning. I love this warning. Remember that we deal with alcohol. Cunning. Baffling. Powerful. The things that I've heard that are added to that, which I love, there's two things that I've heard. That it's patient and jealous. And I love that. I was like, when I heard that, that was another one of like, oh my God, wow, they're not lying. Because it is, it's patient. Alcohol is patient. No, that's all right. You want to be sober? Go be sober. I'll be here. It's okay. No. I'll be here 30 years from now. Don't you worry. I'll be here when you're ready. And then it talks to us. It lets us know, oh, you don't need her. I'm always here for you. I always do what you want me to do. I don't nag at you. I always want to be with you. You know, those types of little thoughts, you know, it's really, and that's that cunning, baffling, powerful, and jealous, you know, like, I know for me, the more I'm being spiritual, the harder my life becomes, because the world is not meant for spirituality. That's been my experience. Like, the harder you work at trying to be good, you're not that. People want to challenge that. He can't really be that good, can he? You know, and so it becomes that sort of thing. And so I love the ominous warning there. And then he lets us know, without help, it is too much for us. And then here's the solution. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. And it just becomes like, my experience with that was like, you got to be kidding me. You've got to be kidding me. The answer is God? Oh, I'm doomed. Because I didn't want that answer. Well, come on. How could that? And then, over the years, the cleverness of people. To me, I think it's alcohol being clever, really. Being cunning, baffling, and powerful. You know, that God, that you know, good orderly direction. Group of drunks. And I'm like, oh, wow, really? I'm like, good orderly direction? That sounds like me running crap. Group of drunks? I don't think so. There were no group of drunks stopping me from drinking when I was drinking. I know that. You know, so I just didn't, like, I couldn't groove with that quote-unquote humanistic God, really. You know, I knew it wasn't me. I was okay with that. Okay, I'm not it. But it definitely was nothing human. And so that's as far as I could get. So I kind of, like, I got to find him. I got to find God now. Okay, well, how am I going to do that? Well, here we go. Half measures avail us nothing. Now, that's pretty bold right there. You know, well, half in, half out. You know, you hear that all the time in the rooms. You know, you get what you put into this program, you get out of it. No, you don't. Apparently not. If you put half measures into it, you're going to get nothing out of it. I've seen that. I know other people have experienced that. You know, that those people, those you know, I like to call them those golden newcomers, you know. Mm-hmm. They come in and they're there. And they're counting days, and every day their hand goes up. 14, 15. Oh, you got a coffee commitment? Oh, I go to a meeting every day. I'm here. And they're sharing, and they sound good. You know, people tell them, hey, you sound good. Hey, you're looking good. And, oh, boy, I'm looking good. Sounding good. And then they're drunk. And people go, how did that happen? And I say, well, half measures. What do you mean half measures? They were doing this and this. Where was God? I just can never get past that. If somebody, to me, Tim's opinion, if somebody relapses, God was missing. Maybe they had God, but they certainly weren't relying on God at that point. God was like, no, God may have been saying, listen, you can't have a drink. No, I'm drinking. Because remember, it talks about, remember we deal with alcohol, cunning, battling, powerful. Without help, it's too much for us. So, if there's a relapse happening, there's no God there, because God has all power. If you have God, God's going to kick alcohol's butt. Every time. I've never seen it fail. I've shared that story about me being close to a relapse, and it came down to what we talked about earlier on, that my defense came from a higher power. There was no human power there. It was between me and God. That was it. Me and God between a drink. And God kicked his butt. And I've never doubted it since then. And I've annoyed everybody in the world since then as the result. And I don't care. Okay. We stood at the turning point. That's pretty cool. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. I kind of liken that too. I don't understand people who jump out of perfectly good airplanes. But to me, I kind of liken it to that. People who skydive and they go out, yay, complete abandon. You know, and I always love talking to people who are like that, who are like quote-unquote adrenaline junkies. They jump out of planes or they ski double black diamonds here or there. And I'm like, and you still don't believe in God? Well, no, I'm doing it. I'm like, oh, boy. Okay, good talking to you. Right? So then he says, quite plainly, here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. Now, it's not a program of suggestions. It's a suggested program. Now, my experience with programs in the computer world, a program is a set of instructions that you start at the beginning. The instructions follow one after the other, and it gives you a result. If something in the instructions are wrong, it's not going to give you the proper end result. If you try to move the instructions around, you're not going to get the proper end result. The program is broken. There's something wrong with the program. However, if there's a program that's designed to print your name on the screen by typing the keys on the keyboard, there's instructions to that. And it'll even tell you, type your name. You type your name. Now, if you type somebody else's name, or if you type your name and it gives you somebody else's name, there's obviously something wrong with the program. If I type in Tim and it comes up with Bob, they're way off, man. And yet here it is, there's a suggested program of recovery. So, directions, like he stated before, earlier, clear-cut directions. Okay. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. I always like to point out here that it says were. We were powerless. We'll get to that controversy in a minute. And the dash. I talk about the dash. The dash in the English language means that you use the subject and the predicate of the previous sentence between the sentences. So in this case, it would be, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. We admitted that our lives had become unmanageable. That's how it's supposed to be read. There's no and in there. There's no comma. There's no but. That's how it's presented. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order! I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is, we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Okay. Now, if we look at those steps individually, like I said, it said we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, and we admitted that our lives had become unmanageable. Now, I've talked about this before, the difference between admission and willingness. You know, an admission is a reluctant agreement. It's a reluctant agreement. It's kind of like, did you take that cookie? No, not really. Come on, I saw you take the cookie. Okay, I took the cookie. That's an admission. And I admitted it. Are you powerless over alcohol? I don't know. Well, you're an AA. Okay, I guess I'm powerless over. You know, so that's the beginning. You know, and one of the things that always jumps out at me is like, well, where else does it mention? Where else does alcohol mention in the steps? It's not. It's the rest of the steps are designed to talk about a spiritual experience as the result of them. Like, that's what it says on the 12th step. So if you draw a line, if you put them on the board, where are they? To my right. So if you look at this and you draw a line after 11, and you add up 1 through 12, the result is going to be your spiritual awakening. I mean, it's really cool to look at it that way. Okay, if I do this, I'm going to have a spiritual awakening. Well, what's that going to do? Oh, that's going to revolutionize how I look at the world. It's going to revolutionize how I look at God, how I look at people in the world, and how I look at alcohol, really. It's going to give me an entire psychic change. It's going to transform my thinking, which we read earlier is the crux of the problem. And as the result of that, I'm going to find it easy to control my desire for alcohol, which to me is why I think he wrote, "We're powerless." Because people who follow this program and got a God in their life now have the one who has all power. So if you have God, you have power over alcohol. Because God's got it. You don't have to worry about it. I know I don't have to worry about it. Someone offers me a drink? No thanks. And then, you know, it's amazing, like, my education is in the field of counseling. So through classes, you have to do what they call experiential learning. So you sit in groups, and you have to pretend that you're somebody, you know, pushing for a drink. And well, how do you teach people how to refuse the drink properly, you know, with manners? You know, to me, like, get the F out of here is fine. You know, like, what's wrong with that? But it becomes like, come on, have a drink with me. Oh, I don't drink. What, you can't have just one? You know, and it just becomes that banter that they want to teach you how to do. Okay, so to me, if you're fortified with the one who has all power, you no longer have to worry about that. Somebody offers you a drink. No thanks. And you don't drink? Nope. Why not? I don't. And, you know, you could take that to whatever extreme. Some people like to get clever. I'm allergic to it. Oh, really? Yeah, I break out in handcuffs. You know, there's all those cute things people say. And that's fine, because that should be the level of comfortability that people have with that. And to me, that's between somebody and their own God and their own higher power. Like, well, what's God want me to say? Because if we're truly living this life, that's where we're turning to. Come on, God, give me an answer. You know, and sometimes, you know, my God's a bit abrupt and abrasive, so that's why I get the F out of here kind of sound sometimes, you know. But there it is. So then moving on, and then we come to two. Now to me, like, you get to one and you're like past one now. I know I was excited. Oh yeah, I'm powerless over alcohol. Oh yeah, my life was definitely unmanageable. Remember we dealt with that on 52, the bedevilment talks about that. Right. So when I was good with that, now what? Okay, next question. Are you insane? What do you mean? insane. Are you insane?
Well, I don't know. I'm a little crazy, you know.
But what do you mean by insane? Okay, well, do you keep doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results?
Well, like what?
With everything. You know, because I know for me, it was always, like, when I came to AA, I was compartmentalizing my drinking. Like, my life stopped at the door, and AA was all about my drinking. So when people said life, asked me life questions, I didn't get it.
Well, you're talking about my...
No, yeah, I'm not... Well, I'm not really insane. I mean, I know if I have it, you know, this beer is going to lead to another beer, so, okay, I'm not really insane. But, oh, my God, so it just becomes that argument, you know? So once I'm able to get to a point where I can admit that I do the same thing over and over again, expecting different results, that's a big freedom. Because now I can face yet another problem. Oh, well, I am insane. Well, I want to be restored to sanity. Now I have to believe that that one that has all power can do that. Which is a very difficult task. Okay, so once I finally get past that, I'm like, okay, yeah, God can take care of God. God has all power, should be able to do it. Like that question in 55, God is everything, God is nothing, he either is or he isn't, what's your choice to be? But I'm confronted with that, now I'm stuck. Okay, God's everything when it comes to my drinking, you know. God is when it comes to my drinking. No, everything or nothing. So now I'm like, okay, now I'm stripped. Now I have no power in and of myself. I believe that there's something out there that's not human, not me, that has all power. Now what? Okay. So now it gets into the next part of on page 60, where Bill says, our description of the alcoholic. Silkworth, his own story, more about alcoholism. The chapter to the agnostic. Okay? Our personal adventures before and after. All the stories that he tells throughout the book up until this point. Make clear three pertinent ideas. Pertinent meaning important, of the utmost importance. Clear meaning not up for debate, meaning crystal, not nebulous, not blurry. Okay, so what are they? That we were alcoholic and could not manage our lives. Okay. That probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. Okay. That God could and would if he were sought. Okay. The very next line, being convinced we were at step three, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to God as we understood him. Just what do we mean by that and just how do we do it? And just what do we do? Excuse me. Okay, so being convinced. I need to be convinced. Okay? And I've experienced lots of people in AA needing to be convinced of those three pertinent ideas. For years. Some people, it takes a long time. I feel bad for those people. And I don't mean like, you know, 6 months. I mean like 6 years. You know, like 10 plus years, 20 years. People not being convinced that no human power could remove their alcoholism. Oh my God, that would just be a nightmare for me. I wouldn't be here, I know that. It's tough enough just to live knowing that God's got everything. But for me to have to do it, oh please, next, you know? Okay, so then he goes on to, like, okay, here's some instructions. The first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. I know, like I say all the time, if I'm running it, it's wrong. It's messed up. It gets messed up all the time. I watch it in the rooms. How many times do we see people? Because I know there's people in this room who've experienced people who are of the nature of the, I don't really believe in this whole God thing. I don't drink and go to meetings. I go to a lot of meetings, and they're miserable. Mm-hmm. And they're constantly bitching about how bad their life is. You know, and they, you know, and they're usually like people who run businesses too, which always scares me. I'm like, I actually had a guy ask me to run his business. This is going back, I don't know, probably 8-9 years ago. And he picks me up and he's like driving around. And he said, yeah, I wanted your, I said, I would never run your business. And he's looked at me, he says, why not? I said, because you're nuts, man. I'm like, you're out of your mind. He's like, what do you mean? I'm like, dude, you're a control freak. Everything has to be your way. If somebody doesn't do it exactly the way you want to do it, they're idiots. And now I got to fire them. And you're a nut. And this person is still that way. Still that way. And miserable. Miserable. And I always love the people who say, I'm happy. Wow, I hate to see when they're miserable, right? My God. Amazing. Right, so that self-will, that I'm thinking for me. Because that's what I've learned, that our will is our thinking, and that our life is our actions. So when I'm turning my thinking over to the care of that one who I believe will restore me to sanity, who will give me power over alcohol, who will manage my life, now I'm going to the right place. Now my thinking is going in the right direction. When my actions go toward that little voice in my head that tells me to do the right thing, I'm going in the right direction. Right? I'm not running my life on self-propulsion. And then Bill says, it can hardly be a success. On that basis, on the basis of self-will, we are almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. I've met lots of people whose motives are wonderful, but yet there they are, smashing into somebody. Because they didn't stop to think about how their actions are going to affect another person. It's all about what they want to do. And I've gone through that plenty of times. Well, I want to tell somebody about something good that somebody did. And then I do, and I'm like, isn't that great? No. Well, why not? Well, maybe they didn't want somebody to tell. And now I feel bad. Now I'm like, oh, I just blew like somebody's good deed for the day, maybe, or something like that. But yet my intentions were good, right? So most people try to live by self-propulsion. Each person, now here's this is a funny story. I'll read this first and I'll tell you. Each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show. He's forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in his own way. If his arrangements would only stay put, if only people would do as he wished, the show would be great. Everybody, including himself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. In trying to make these arrangements, our actor may sometimes be quite virtuous. He may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. On the other hand, he may be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. But as with most humans, he is more likely to have varied traits. What usually happens? The show doesn't come off very well. He begins to think life doesn't treat him right. He decides to exert himself more. He becomes on the next occasion still more demanding or gracious as the case may be. Still, the play does not suit him. Admitting he may be somewhat at fault, he is sure that other people are more to blame. He becomes angry, indignant, self-pitying. What is his basic trouble? Is he not really a self-seeker even when trying to be kind? Is he not a victim of the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if he only manages well? Is it not evidence to all the rest of the players that these are the things that he wants? And do not his actions make each of them wish to retaliate, snatching all they can get out of the show? Is he not even in his best moments a producer of confusion rather than harmony? Our actor is self-centered, egocentric, as people like to call it nowadays. He's like the retired businessman who lolls in the Florida sunshine in the winter, complaining of the sad state of the nation. The minister who sighs over the sins of the 20th century. Politicians and reformers who are sure all would be utopia if the rest of the world would only behave. The outlaw safecracker who thinks society has wronged him. And the alcoholic who has lost all and is locked up. Whatever our protestations, are not most of us concerned with ourselves, our resentments, or our self-pity? Okay, so there's a lot there. Now, the funny part about that is that when I got here, this is how whacked I was. I am an actor, literally. You know, I've been performing for a long time. So when I got here and I read this, I was horrified. I was just like, what? I can't be an actor anymore? I went to my sponsor. I'm like, but when I direct, I have to arrange the lights. I have, like, and he would be like, relax, Tim. It's not literal. And I'm like, oh, thank God. He's like, but there are things that apply to you. I'm like, oh my, now what? Because when I read this, you know, he may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest, and self-sacrificing. On the other hand, he may be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. Now, if you have any experience in the theater world, when you read that, you go, yeah. Uh-huh. And what's wrong with that? Okay, because in that world, unfortunately, a lot of that is the reality. And I know people who are quite successful, who are celebrities, who are Oscar winners, those types of things, and I've had conversations with them about it. You know, like, do you think you could have... And they're in recovery. And there's a lot of them, believe me. There's a lot of people. For every one that you see, there's like 15 you don't know about. And it was really cool to talk to them and ask them about it. And I've always asked every one of them, I've asked, do you think you could have been successful in your career now that you're in recovery, that you're sober? And every single one of them said, no way. There's no way I could have done it. Because it takes a selfish, self-centered mind. It takes that it's all about me in order to become that person in that field. And this is what their experience were. And when I got sober, a lot of that went away for me because I started to feel bad about being mean, about it being all about me, about get out of my way, this is my moment. I started to feel bad about that. So it's become more of a passion or an avocation for me, something that I feel that God has given me gifts that I pass on. And that's where I keep it. I keep it at that level. So it was really funny that so here I was, new to recovery and very confused because now this book was really about me. Because that's what he said to me when he handed me this book. He said, read it, it's all about you. And when I got here, I was really like, oh my God, it really is. Now, halfway down to the second paragraph where he says, he's not a victim of the delusion that he can rest, satisfaction, and happiness out of this world if he only manages well. Now, I find that interesting, that statement, that's a pretty bold, once again, confrontational statement. Victim of a delusion. Okay, so what's the delusion? The delusion is, I can rest satisfaction, meaning I can wrestle it away from this world. How? And happiness. Well, how? If I manage well. But didn't we just admit that our lives could become unmanageable? And yet, this is one of those things that gets ignored when new people show up and we tell them, start managing your life. Don't drink, go to meetings. Well, what's that if not manage your life? And that's a delusion. Those people who are getting that are becoming victims of a delusion that they can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of managing their life. It's not going to happen. I mean, it's nice to, like, okay, instead of go to the bar, go to a meeting. Okay, there's that, but that in and of itself, I can't tell you. I don't know about anybody else's experience being new in recovery. I was really angry. Going to meetings, being really angry. I was the victim of the delusion that I could rest satisfaction and happiness out of managing my life by going to meetings. Talking through my teeth. How are you, Tim? I'm fine. Going to meetings. It didn't work. I needed God. I needed God. Needed it. Right? Okay, so now we get to some heavy stuff here on 62. I love this. And this is it right here. It says, selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. So there it is. The root of our troubles, selfishness and self-centeredness. Everything else in our life comes from that. Whatever fancy word we want to give it, whatever degree we want to take it out to, ultimately we can come right back to, it's selfish. It's self-centered. That's the root of my trouble. Now I have to really identify it, right? Then he says, this is really cool. I always talk about this as my self-car, right? Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. So like I said, I like to imagine like I'm in a car of self. I'm in my selfish, self-centered car, and I have my four wheels of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. And I drive over the toes of my fellows, and they retaliate. And I'm like, what? Well, you shouldn't have had your foot there. Don't you know I'm driving? You know, like that becomes my mindset, right? And then we said, well, sometimes they hurt us. Okay, so that's okay. And this is seemingly without provocation. which I love, seemingly without provocation. And then there's that little, like, needle that he gives us, right? But invariably we find it sometime in the past, we made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Right? Now, to me, it's really cool that where he says that it's an extreme example of self-will run riot. Doesn't mean that alcoholics are the only people who are self-will run riot. Just an extreme one. Right? Now, here's a thing. Above everything, another absolute statement, right? We alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. God makes that possible. And there often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without His aid. Many of us had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we could not live up to them even though we would have liked to. Neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own power. We had to have God's help. What seems to be the recurring theme here? It's about God. God's the only thing. It's the only one that can remove self. And above everything, what do you mean, above everything? Isn't stopping drinking more important than that? No. Because obviously, if I'm going to continue to be selfish and self-centered, I'm going to go back to drinking anyway. Because I'm going to be driven by fear and self-delusion and self-seeking and self-pity. And don't you know, I need to drink. Because I need to. I. Right? And then it becomes about, well, how do we do this? And he gives us credit. Many of us had moral and philosophical convictions galore. I know I did. I thought I was a pretty swell guy. I was nice to people. I always helped people. But don't get in my way when it gets... You first, after me. That was my mentality, right? So, and obviously, that was the wrong way. Because that's why I'm in AA, because I was doing it wrong. And the only thing is God. God makes that possible. It doesn't say going to meetings makes that possible. It says God makes that possible. Okay. Bottom of 62, he says, this is the how and the why of it. And here's a statement that I say to people all the time, and I get yelled at for it. I get yelled at for saying this, right? It says, first of all, we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. I say that to people all the time. Do you know that? You need to quit playing God. Doesn't work.
Well, why would you say that to somebody? What?
Well, what book are you reading? What program are you in? I don't get it. It says it right there. First, it doesn't say second after this. It says, first of all, we need to quit playing God. It didn't work. Next, another direction. We decided that hereafter in this drama of life, oh, look at this. God was going to be our director. He is the principal, we are His agents. He is the Father, and we are His children. Most good ideas are simple, and this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we passed to freedom. Wow! What a promise. What a gorgeous vision that is, right? Talked about it before, the foundation. Foundation being step one. Laying cement, pouring it out, smoothing it over, getting rid of reservations, getting rid of lurking notions, and it's there. And now we can build this wonderful structure. Because we knocked down the old one. We can't patch it up. Got to knock down. Old ideas, they got to go. So we build this beautiful, nice foundation. Right? And we talked about in step two that our cornerstones were fixed in place. Cornerstones. Okay? And he talks about building an arch. So we have these two wonderful cornerstones in our arch, and we're building this arch. Now, a keystone is within the middle of the arch and holds the structure together. So without a keystone, the arch is going to collapse. If you look at architecture, you'll see it in the middle. That keystone is there. And that simple idea, that God is the thing that holds our arch together, is what it's a new, triumphant arch through which we will pass to freedom. Oh, wow, that's just gorgeous, right? And then he says again, page 63, he says, when we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer. Being all-powerful, he provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we can contribute to life. as we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of His presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. We were reborn. Now, we talked about this earlier, that if we took such an attitude toward God, we cannot fail. And He says it again. When we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things happened. When I sincerely turned my will and my life, my thinking and my actions over to the care of my God that stopped me from drinking, that said I'm going to die, made those words come out, made me pick up that phone and call my crazy buddy who was still drinking. When I sincerely took that position, when I stopped fighting and said, it ain't me, I can't do this, man. All sorts of remarkable things happened. I lost weight. I became a better actor. Was nominated for awards. All sorts of remarkable things. And even more importantly than that, I was able to face mental illness and go through that. I was able to face marriage and divorce. I was able to face death. I was able to face bankruptcy. I was able to face all these quote-unquote horrible things because I trusted that this is exactly what was supposed to go on in my life. I hear that all the time. Like, people tell these stories, and obviously it had to be God because they got what they wanted. Well, what about when you don't get what you want? God's not involved in that? BS, man, because God is involved in that. Because sometimes I'm still running on self-will. I'm still being self-propelled. And God has a way of putting a brick wall in front of me to make me smack into it and go, oh, yeah, self-car again. Driving in my self-car. You know, so it becomes like, oh, wow. And you hear that all the time. It means you hear that from the podium. And God's great because I got what I wanted. Well, let's see when stuff is going bad in your life, you know. Then we'll see how great God is. Right? And that's what it took for me. I don't know for anybody else. That's what it took for me. That's what really took at like 9 and 10 years of recovery for me to really get a hold of God. My life fell apart. And I went, but I'm helping people, but I'm not drinking, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing, I'm getting outside of myself, I'm thinking of others and how I may help meet their needs. Why is my life falling apart? Because that's what God wanted. And as soon as I accepted that that's what God wanted, what a relief I had. I had serenity, man. I knew peace. I knew serenity. It was amazing. And people were like, what's up with you? I'm like, nothing. Wow, your life is pretty crappy. Yeah. Well, aren't you upset? No. Why not? God's got it. Well, you know, and then of course people talking out the side of their neck about Big Book 10, you know. Oh, he's nuts, he's over there, he's got no God. AA people, I'm not talking, like, I can understand it out there, but AA people thinking like I'm nuts because I'm relying on God. How dare I, you know? So it was pretty amazing to see that, right? And to me that was yet another spiritual awakening in my life as the result of these steps. Because that's what it takes. I don't just stop. Oh, okay, I had one. Okay, that's it. I'm good. I'm done forever. Yay. Right. Now, we were now at step 3. Here we go. Many of us said to our Maker as we understood Him, God, I offer myself to Thee to build with me and do with me as Thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do Thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of Thy power, Thy love, and Thy way of life. May do Thy will always. Now here's an instruction. We thought well before taking this step. What's that word? Thought. Oh, we thought. Don't we tell people? Don't think. I hear it all the time. Oh, are you thinking again? Well, yeah, I have a brain. Uh-oh, someone is in trouble. They're thinking, you know. We thought well. Before taking this step. Okay, well, why? Making sure we were ready. Am I ready to do this? Am I ready to offer myself to God? To build with me and do with me as God will? To relieve me of the bondage of self? I don't know about anybody else. I kind of like myself, you know what I mean? My self-redemption. All about me. I like my accolades. Right? Take away my difficulties. I was like that, you know, that angst-ridden, like, that James Dean kind of guy, you know? Like, if you took away my difficulties, who was going to be left? What was I going to do? I always had to have a problem to overcome, you know? So when I said, take away my difficulties, that victory over them will bear witness to those I would help. Not to me. Of your power, your love, your way of life. May I do your will always. Wow, I got to think about that. And rightly so. I have to think about that. Right? And then what's the other requirements? That I could at last abandon ourselves utterly to Him. Whew. Abandon utterly? Wow, now you're talking religious terms over here. I don't know if I could do that. Utterly? I can't run the show? I can't, a little bit? How about sometimes? Maybe on Saturdays. No, utterly. Oh, wow. I had to think about that. Right? And then it says, we found it very desirable to take this step with an understanding person, such as our wife, best friend, or spiritual advisor. But it is better to meet God alone than with one who might misunderstand. The wording was, of course, quite optional, so long as we expressed the idea, voicing it without reservation. This was only a beginning, though if honestly and humbly made, an effect, sometimes a very great one, was felt at once. Now, my experience going through this process with people, because I'm generally somebody's spiritual advisor, right? Now, this is the only time that I ever, not really insist, but suggest strongly that someone prays out loud, because it says it. Voicing it without reservation. Voicing means to give it voice. Simple definition. And it's the only time that I do that, because I feel that people's prayers are personal. Right? The idea that those are good words to begin with. The wording's optional so long as those ideas are there. Now, there's the other side of things. There's that, no, we're going to get down on our knees, and you're going to say this out loud, and you're going to do it again, and you have to humbly offer yourself. I still haven't found where it says we got down on our knees. I mean, I know there's traditions of that. I know there's history of that. But this is the book that I'm following here. This is the program of recovery that's set out in this book. It does not say that I need to kneel. Nowhere does it say that. And then it also says, but it's better to meet God alone than with somebody that might misunderstand. Well, if someone's insisting that I kneel, or someone's insisting that I do something a certain way, I'm going to meet God alone. Because this person obviously doesn't understand. That's the thing there. So for me, it's important to point that stuff out. Because this is a turning point right here. It's a turning point, and we're about to see that. It says next. Ooh, construction. We've launched out on a course of vigorous action. The first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us have never attempted. Right? Though our decision was a vital and crucial step. Remember, vital, necessary for life. Crucial, the turning point, the crux. It could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. Our liquor was but a symptom, so we had to get down to the causes and conditions. Wow. You're kidding me, right? Now I gotta do work? Because that's the hook. You know, once we get you to do that third step, you're screwed. Because now you have to launch out onto a course of rigorous action. I mean, like, I think about that rigorous action, you know. A guy that I work with, he just did this tough mutters thing, which is a course of rigorous action. You know, where you're launching yourself into, like, freezing water and then running 12 miles and doing, like, yay, this is great. Like, but you won't do a fourth step, you know, like that kind of thing. Right? So to me, it's kind of like, there it is. And then it's really cool where it says here, it can have a little permanent effect. Permanent effect. So that means the decision that I just made, because that's what step three is. I made a decision. I said a prayer to my higher power, to my God. giving myself to higher, to my higher power, to build with me, relieve me of the bondages, all that stuff. That decision, it's necessary for my life. It's the crux. It's the turning point. And it could be permanent. That could be permanent. Well, how? How could it be permanent?
I'm glad you asked.
Strenuous effort to face and be rid of. Not, I got it. Hey, look, you like this? This is my character defect. I'm going to keep this with me. No, be rid of it. Get rid of it, because it's blocking me off from God. That's what is blocked. That's the block right there, right? And then he goes on and he says, therefore, we started upon a personal inventory. And he gives us another hint. This was step four, right? A business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. Taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding and fact-facing process. It is an effort to discover the truth about the stock in trade. One object is to disclose damaged or unsaleable goods, to get rid of them promptly and without regret. If the owner of a business is to be successful, he cannot fool himself about values. So I see that and it says, okay, well, if an alcoholic is to recover and become recovered and stay permanently recovered, he can't fool himself about the values of character defects. Can't fool himself about the values of it, right? So, and he says that. We did exactly the same thing with our lives. We took stock honestly. And then he's going to give us some instructions. First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup which caused our failure. And here's this phrase again. Being convinced that self, manifested in various ways, was what had defeated us, we considered its common manifestations. Okay, so let's look at that sentence. It's kind of like English challenged right there. So if we look at it, it said, being convinced that self had is what had defeated us. Self is what had defeated us. Okay. It was manifested in various ways. Self manifested in various ways is what defeats. So obviously self is what's defeating me. Because we read that before. Selfishness is the root of my trouble. We considered its common manifestations. And then he says, resentment is the number one offender. So we have this huge pile of self. Right? All these manifestations of self. And on top of it is resentment is the biggest one. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. Right? From it stem all forms of spiritual disease, which, by the way, that's the only time you see disease in the first 164. He's going to state the problem and the solution in two sentences right here. For we have not only been mentally and physically ill, we've been spiritually sick. That's our problem right there. Now here's the solution. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out physically and mentally. That's a pretty big promise. Spiritual malady. Once we get God in our life, we're going to straighten out mentally and obviously going to straighten out physically. Why wouldn't we seek God? Why wouldn't we grab a hold of this? What do you mean? My problem is this, and that's all I need to do is get God, and I'm going to straighten out? Where do I start? But if you're anything like me, no. It's not that easy. Don't you know who I am? I got this problem and that problem, right? Okay, now he's given some instructions here. He says, in dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. We set them on paper. I can't tell you how many times I've heard in meetings, I've never done a written forward step. Well, then shut up. Stop telling people how to get sober then. You're killing people. That's my opinion. You're killing people. Because it says resentment's the number one offender. Okay? And it says in dealing with resentments, we set it on paper. So if you're dealing with all these resentments and you never took them out of your head and put them on paper and you're dragging them around through your life and you're sponsoring people with all of your wonderful resentments, you're killing people. I've seen it. Like, that's like, hey, here's the cliff. Walk off it, son, you know? So we listed people, institutions, or principles with whom we were angry. We asked ourselves why we were angry. In most cases, it was found that our self-esteem, our pocketbooks, our ambitions, our personal relationships, including sex, were hurt or threatened. So we were sore, we were burned up. On our grudge list, we set opposite each name our injuries. Was it our self-esteem, our security, our ambitions, our personal or sex relations, which had been interfered with? We were usually as definite as this example. And then there's the chart here on 65. Now, for me, this was really important. I was so glad that he actually wrote it like this, because I remembered it. When I got sober, I remember people talking about the fourth step like it was the boogeyman. You know, oh, should you do the fourth step? Ooh. And then I remember, oh, wait a minute. That's in that book. It looks different. Because it does. It looks different than every other step. And there it is. So I was able to go back and be like, oh, wow, this is cool. Now, I'm not going to read down through it. You can do that. And then it says important stuff at the bottom here. Is that we went back through our lives. Through our lives. Which means as far back as we could remember. Unfortunately for me, that was like 3. Because I can remember back that far, right? And then it says, nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. Nothing. Nothing counted. Well, no. Well, it's neat. No. It's in columns. No. Nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. When we were finished, we considered it carefully. Oh, wow, we have to think again. Consider, because that's what considering is doing, thinking, right? The first thing apparent was that the world and its people were often quite wrong. To conclude that others were wrong was as far as most of us ever got. The usual outcome was that people continued to wrong us and we stayed sore. Sometimes it was remorse, and then we were sore at ourselves. But the more we fought and tried to have our own way, the worse matters got. As in war, the victor only seemed to win. Our moments of triumph were short-lived. Now, we're coming up to the end here, because I'm long-winded, so, and we're on page 66. So for me, I think it's important that we're thorough with this. And so I'd like to start with the book side of things. Now, with that, I actually have here, if anybody wants to look at it, a resentment inventory prompt sheet that I've found. And I find it's one, because for me, it becomes like, well, I'm not really resentful about stuff. And then I have this, oh, yeah, no, I don't like them. And I don't, oh, I definitely don't like that. You know, and it's this nice list, right? And I have that. So if you want to look at that, that's cool. I could probably get you a copy of that for next week if you're interested. Now, it's important for me to point out resentment. Resentment, the root of the word is sentire, which means to feel. That's the Latin derivative, to feel, sentire. So whenever you put re in front of something, it means to do it again. So if we're, when we have a resentment, it means we're re-feeling something again and again and again. So it doesn't necessarily mean that we're angry. And he mentioned remorse. Sometimes we're sad. Sometimes we have regret. There are those types of feelings, like, you know, and it's important to recognize that being hurt about a particular situation that may have happened 25 years ago in your life is important to write down. Because it's affecting every part of your life, every aspect of your life. You know, and you get people that go, don't worry about it. Listen, if it's in high school, don't worry about it. Well, where does it say that? If it was in grammar school, don't worry about it. Well, where does it say that? I mean, I know there were things in grammar school that affected me greatly. I know there's probably things that I did to other kids that affected them for the rest of their lives. So I can't be judgmental about, I can't, like, just start editing the things that, you know, that I find. Well, they did it to me first. They were using me too. You know, I can't do that crap. Nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. Right. So next week we're going to pick up, I guess, on 66 and finish the rest of the chapter, I hope. Maybe get into action. And so that's it for this week. So I hope I helped somebody. Thank you.
And now it's